there are some members of Poland be coming back. They were seated here. We are joined in by two related institutions. I call the one that is led by Professor Malekgaburu Makgoba, also is a separate, is a twin brother or a twin sister of what we are going to be listening to. I happen to know these colleagues also of my other previous life, but they will still have to introduce themselves to all of us. We are going to be listening to the role of Office of Health Standard Compliance, including the IPP. I'm sure the president is not as long as we have just had here now, so that you can deal with their APP. But I was interested, Professor Makgoba, to see how you are related to this institution. Because when I read, I can glean that they are there to expect compliance in as far as the norms and standards. It's an ongoing. And you sit in another space processing complaints from the citizens. And the citizens may even come and complain, even if the institution where they are working, they are at, is following norms and standards, because some of the issues you relate to may still be about attitude. So there may be some close working relationship. I understand to them that one is interested to see that this clinic, this hospital, complies to these norms for it to be able to, among other things, do 1, 2, 3, 4. And your task is, among other things, to say, even if that institution is complying, do we have a relevant Dr. Zemot there treating people with respect and with all that? So it has to, I'm already preparing you that you can't come to this meeting and leave without saying a word, even if it means clarifying that. And you see, I'm in a very strategic position. He was once my teacher, and now I'm commanding my teacher. But at the time he made me pass medicine, I couldn't do the same. So I just think it's important, Professor Makgoba, to know that in life, roles can change. But also sitting here, I must behave, because next time roles might change again. I might see you being my boss in another space. So I must just behave and not provoke you too much. Honorable members, can you introduce yourself? And then once we finish, you then, Dr. Mdaweni, take over to introduce the delegation. Then you will move into our presentation. I'm Ms. Bongiseni Dlomo, the chairperson of this Portfolio Committee for Health. Behind you, honorable members, we have been joined by members from Uganda. These are members of parliament from Uganda. They are touring our country, and they're in Cape Town, and they requested to come and join and be part of this committee. They are members of Portfolio Committee of Health in Uganda, and there's another portfolio committee there called Portfolio Committee of HIV and AIDS and any other related complications. So, Honorable Sokacha, when we finish, then we move on.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. My name is Mkhulisi Sokacha. I'm a member of the Portfolio Committee on Health.
Chirizumyai, I'm a member of Portfolio Committee of Health. Yeah. Good afternoon, Philip van Staden, member of Portfolio Committee on Health.
Good morning, my name is Anna Keller, member of this Portfolio of Health.
Good morning, my name is Kenneth Jacobs, I'm a member of this Portfolio of Health.
Good morning, my name is Umu Satyaji. I'm a member of the
Portfolio. Good afternoon. My name is Magdalena Duduzi Leshemwa, member of Portfolio Committee Health.
Dr. Susan Tembekoyo, member of Committee on Health. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Naledi Chira, and I'm an alternate member of this Committee on Health.
Honorable Wilson, you are disturbing Honorable Kwakhube.
sorry, Chairperson, I have a crisis. I have issues on our debate. Sorry.
Okay. She's Honorable Wilson, Lord Serving Member. Let me finish on the back row. Thank you. Hope that you have managed the crisis, Honorable Wilson.
My name is Sivile Kwahubi. I'm a member of the Portfolio Committee.
Good morning. My name is Athena Isma, an alternate member of this committee.
Can I hand over to you then, Dr. Darwin, or the chairperson of the you handle the way your protocol allows you to?
Good morning, Chair and the committee members. My name is Uwayizi Audrey Munsiwa, and I'm the acting chairperson of the Office of the Healthcare Standard Compliance.
It's Malgapuru Mahoba. I'm the health ombud.
Sheila Basel. I'm on the board of the Office of Health Standards Compliance.
Stuart Whitaker, member of the board of the Office of Health Standards Compliance.
Julius Mabata, I'm the chief financial officer.
Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. My name is Jitumese Mashangu. I'm the board member of the Office of the Health Standards Compliance.
Good morning, Honourable Members. I'm Olehile Bada Parasi, member of the board of OHSC.
Good morning, Honourable Members. My name is Makwedi Makhoba Madisa. I'm the Director for Certification and Enforcement and currently Acting Director Board Secretariat at the OHSC.
Good morning. I am Matidiso Munso. I'm the Acting Executive Manager for the Inspectorate Unit in the Office of Health Standards Compliance.
Good morning. My name is Monna Tau, the surname is Tolwe. I'm the director responsible for complaint center and assessment within the Office of Health Standard Compliance and the Office of the Health Ombud.
Good morning, honorable members. I'm Sipiwe Mdaweni, the chief executive officer.
From health,
good morning, members. Good morning, Chair. Sorry. Good morning, members. My name is Mitlodzi Mshwana from the Department of Health.
Also, the ministry is represented here from Deputy Minister.
Morning, members and colleagues. My name is Doris Kasamba.
Thank you very much for that. You'll guide us, Dr. Mdaweni, whether it's the chairperson who presents or yourself, which is presenting to us. We would like to give you space. We won't disturb your presentation and to come up to the last slide. We'll note what you are saying, and then we'll take it from there. It may just be important, even honorable, I prefer, before we get into the discussion of that presentation, we also allow Professor Mahoba to just indicate some of the things that I've already raised, because it's just a grey area that we need clarity on. I might as well prepare you, Honourable Professor Mahoba, that even though we did not prepare you for this item, when we engaged with the Department of Health in about a week ago, we indicated to the Department of Health that would like to make sure that they appraise us on how they are monitoring mental health in the country. We are provoked by the work that you did at the City Main. We don't have a copy of that. Anyway, that served on the 50th Parliament, so we were South Africans out there doing our own businesses. We might use that as a background again, not asking you to bring that report, but that background and assisting us as a country to always be alert that we don't have another estimate anywhere part of the country, including going back to Gauteng itself to because I thought the matter has been completely taken care of. Somebody was saying, no, it's like an ongoing process. The completion of that is not there yet. So without going to details, just your take on that, being that person who was an architect of the report, it will assist us in that regard. Again, we are not expecting you to be exhaustive on that topic today, but it's something that we are also interested in going forward. Dr. Mdawin, give it to you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, and once again to all Honorable Members. I am going to take you through the presentation together with the Chief Financial Officer. We will share the mandate of the Office of Health Standard Compliance and also go through the details of the annual performance plan for the financial year 2019-20. Honorable Members would recall that in not-so-distant past, our country established a process and mechanism to respond to poor quality of health care, and those deliberations back then led to the National Health Amendment Bill of 2011, which really set the tone for a regulatory environment in the country. That was followed by the National Health Amendment Act, which then established the Office of Health Standard Compliance as an independent entity, completely detached from the National Department of Health. The mandate of the office, as it is captured in the Act, is to protect and promote the health and safety of users of our health services. And this we do by monitoring and enforcing compliance by health establishments with norms and standards that are prescribed by the minister in relation to our national health system. We also ensure that there is consideration, investigation, and disposal of complaints relating to non-compliance with prescribed norms and standards in a procedurally fair, economical, and expeditious manner. As I go through the presentation, we will explain this part, because this is where the health ombud lies within the Office of Health Standard Compliance. Now, the two operative words, which is to protect and promote, to protect would imply that the state has a responsibility to protect citizens from harm. This means that the regulations are mainly for public interest to reduce any serious harm that may occur whilst they are receiving services in our health establishment. And to promote, it implies that the state needs to play an active role in quality and safety of these health services. We'll all agree that as we work towards a universal healthcare coverage, the quality of the services that are provided is actually very important. Our mission is captured as the safe and quality healthcare for all South Africans, and we wish to achieve this through the objectives as captured in our mission: to act independently, impartially, fairly, and fearlessly on behalf of the people of South Africa in guiding, monitoring, and enforcing healthcare safety and quality standards in all our health establishments. As an organization, we've got values that are informed by our constitution as well as the Batho-Pele principles, and this implies that our values shall, as an office, we will act as a champion of the public for the healthcare users to restore the credibility and trust of the users of the healthcare services in our health system. We also respect the health users and their families, and including the healthcare workers themselves. As an office, we'll always push for effectiveness in achieving health system change and the social impact. We always strive for excellence, innovation, and efficiency, given the limited resources that we have. And of course, to be truthful, fair, and committed to intellectual honesty. We always endeavor to practice transparency, but highly respecting confidentiality as we deal with some sensitive information, and also to achieve the highest standards of ethical behavior, teamwork, and collaboration, and of course to always promote professionalism, compassion, diversity, and the social responsibility. Now, the National Health Act of number 12 of 2013, Section 79 of this Act details all those activities that the office should and must do, and I'm going to take the members through them, because this is quite important for all members to understand that the Office of Health Standard Compliance One of the activities that we should do is to advise the Minister of Health in determining the norms and standards to be prescribed for the national health system, and not only advise the Minister, but also review the implementation of those norms and standards. The usual process is that we will start with the development of the norms and standards, which will be submitted after board approval to the minister. The minister will then go through a consultative process up until they are then promulgated as regulations, which we then take and further synthesize and then use for compliance in the health establishments. We are required and we should inspect and certify health establishments as either compliant or non-compliant with the prescribed norms and standards. We also have the responsibility to make overall recommendations for intervention by the various levels in the healthcare sector, being it national, provincial, and even municipal, based on the findings that we would have analyzed emanating from the inspections that we conduct. As a regulatory entity, we then also do form collaborations and enter into memoranda of agreement with other regulatory entities within our space so that we can be able to better utilize our resources and there could be cross-referral of some of the work that comes to our office. Again, in the same section, Section 79 of the National Health Act, there are activities or responsibilities that we may do. Let me explain to the honorable members that although these, and in the Act it says we may do, I should confirm that the office has undertaken to fulfill all these responsibilities, because we all understand that regulation in the healthcare sector, it is something that is fairly new. So other than advising the minister developing the standards, we're supposed to issue guidelines that would assist the health establishment to implement the prescribed norms and standards. We also have to monitor these norms and standards, and we do that by requesting and collecting information that pertains to these standards and thereby analyze the information and further inform the minister on the implementation. We also liaise with other regulatory bodies, and we also then enter into cooperative agreements. Now, I'm going to talk to this slide much later. I will just browse through it for now. The powers of the Office of Health Standard Compliance and the implications. What I've just described in the two slides, which is that the must and the may responsibilities of the office, could be summarized as following, that we diagnose, which is mainly the monitoring of compliance as well as ensuring that there is compliance. We advise on the regulations. We also recommend interventions. And in the instance where there is persistent non-compliance with these norms and standards, the office does have powers to enforce action, and I will talk to this later. Now, why do we actually regulate in the healthcare sector? There's some behavior that we seek to change, and really this is going back to the basics of patient care. There's behavior that we want to promote and recognize, and systems to assess and control risk to safety and quality. So our healthcare system should be in such a way that we can be able to identify risk and be able to act on it timelessly. And we also want to promote behavior that's more patient-focused or patient-centered, that is user-focused, compassionate, respectful, and available. We also want to encourage behavior that is provider-focused, that our healthcare workers and providers should always strive to be effective and efficient in delivering the healthcare services. And of course, we want the healthcare workers and our health system in its entirety to be more proactive than to be reactive in problem solving. And we would want to have managers and healthcare providers that are accountable to others and would also hold others accountable. There is behavior that we wish to then discourage by regulating, that is taking ad hoc and arbitrary actions or decisions, and we know that in our sector, a decision that is taken arbitrarily may actually cause a loss of life. We also want to discourage impunity for abuse of power and negligence and just simply non-delivery on what we are supposed to do.
Of course, we do not want to encourage behavior that would accept mediocrity, the whole notion of it is not my fault. We want to enforce the accountability and the just culture instead of the blame culture in our health establishments. I'm going to take the honorable members through some of the core activities of the Office of Health Standard Compliance. I will start with the inspections, which really is the activity of going into health establishments using tools and then want to find whether the health establishment is compliant or non-compliant with the norms and regulations. Now, it starts with the appointment of inspectors. The inspectors that are actually employed in the Office of Health Standard Compliance hold various professional qualifications registered with the different professional bodies, the Allied Health Professions Council, the Health Professions Council, South African Nursing Council, and the South African Pharmacy Council. This is just to demonstrate the diversity of the skills that we have among the inspectors. Now, the inspectors, the assessors, and the investigators that work with the health ombud, it is required, you know, in the Act that they must all be trained aligned to the regulations. And once they are trained, they are supposed to be appointed as inspectors, which is a process, an internal process that we go through. We are also required by the Act to develop and disseminate an annual inspection strategy. So at the end of each financial year, or as before the beginning of each financial year, we're supposed to disseminate and ensure that all health establishments have the strategy available. And why is this important? Because we want health establishments and our various stakeholders to be aware of this, of the strategy and approach that we will be embarking on in that particular financial year. And we'll also then mention some of the resources and limitations that we have or what we are going to use. So this is a valuable document that annually you will find in our website, and it will then guide all the health establishments. And when I say health establishment, honorable members, I do mean both public and private, so that they know exactly what to expect. These inspections, we have different types. We've got what we call routine inspections. This means that each and every health establishment in our country should at least be inspected once in 4 years, and this is also in the Act. We have what's also called additional inspections. A number of things may just trigger an additional inspection, and it means that an inspector from the office may conduct an inspection in a health establishment when there's probably non-compliance or when that the remedies of the non-compliance has not been done. If we feel that a health establishment is contravening the Act or any relevant regulation, if there are serious breaches in norms and standards based on the indicators of risk, and the indicators of risk we determine or we get to know about them through what we call an early warning system. As much as we go out to do inspections, we have established what we call it an early warning system so that some of the issues that relate to patient safety and the quality of care could actually, the health establishment could be able to report them long before we get to them. Then those are some of the conditions that would lead us to conduct an inspection. The ombud investigation may demonstrate that continued exposure to those healthcare services at a particular time may be a risk to the healthcare service users, and that may also spark an inspection. So these additional inspections can happen unannounced. In the past, we used to almost in the main conduct unannounced inspections. With the regulations and with the Act, we now do give a notice to all the health establishments that the office would be coming. However, we're not limited to giving a notice. There may be certain conditions, maybe something that we have seen reported in the media or a serious incident that will then necessitate that the office conduct an unannounced inspection. We also have what you call the risk-based inspections, and this would be more targeted inspections where we'd be looking at a particular instance, as I've said, an example would be through the early warning system or through the ombuds findings. What then happens when our inspectors get to the facilities? The methodology that we use is observation as they enter. We do thorough document review. We do also in-depth patient record analysis, and we conduct interviews with patients and staff. All of this is collected as evidence and will then be analyzed further, and we'll be able to establish whether a health establishment is compliant or non-compliant with the norms and standards. What is an inspection process? What happens when we are about to go to a health establishment? I have mentioned that we give a notice of inspection, which usually is about 7 days. The notice of inspection would contain certain details which are important. It will be the purpose of the inspection. I have described the various types of inspection, so we could mention that it is a routine inspection. But do recall, honorable members, that I said it could actually also be unannounced. We'll also give the date of the inspection. It's usually a range within which, you know, the office would come. We will inform the facility of the estimated duration of this inspection. Usually, small clinics will take us a day. Community healthcare centers, it could be a day or two. And hospitals, depending on the size and the level, will be anything from 3 to 5 days. We'll also give an indication of the number of authorized personnel that we would require to assist the inspectors during the inspections. And we'll also then give contact details of the people that will be conducting the inspection from the office. Now, there are certain responsibilities that are within the health establishment to be carried through during an inspection. Now, the health establishment must make available the necessary staff, the resources, and the space to conduct the inspection. And also, the inspector may question or interview any healthcare personnel in that particular health establishment. And the person in charge, because when they go, the inspectors would introduce themselves, of course, to the person in charge, should make available any relevant information or documentation or records that would be necessary at that point in time. I've been mentioning health establishments. What type of health establishments are we talking about? It's both public and private, all hospitals, all clinics, and the community healthcare centers in the private sector. Now, what do we actually do? What is the measure and the means of inspecting the facilities? We go through a standard evaluation chain. For the purposes of clarity for this presentation, I'm just going to go through this definition so that honorable members can follow as we go forward. We use a process of this evaluation, and we then use the standards. But then we have the following definitions. A domain, when we conduct an inspection, is any aspect of service delivery where quality or safety could be at risk. We call it a domain. Now, subdomains would be a further breakdown or subsections of this domain. When combined, then they give you a domain. A domain is where there could possibly be a risk in quality and safety. Now, standards define what is expected to be delivered in that particular subdomain. So it would reflect the expected situation, that given this situation, what would be reasonable and what type of service should be offered. And this would be done by facilities through ensuring that they adhere to the implementation of policies, procedures in the related functional areas. Then we've got what we call a criteria, and these are elements that set out the requirements to achieve compliance with the standards, and these are measurable and achievable. And measures is evidence that is required, that should have been met in order to meet the criteria. So how we should look at this is actually from the bottom up, that you've got, when we say measure, we are referring to evidence that is required to meet the criteria, and the criteria is elements that you require to meet the standard. The standard then will then give you the subdomains, and then the domain, which is where risk could actually happen in a health establishment. I'm not going to go into detail around this, but how we conduct the inspections is that we'll use the questionnaires, which have got the standards and the measures. So that is how we collect the evidence. And then we go through the same processes as indicators, from measures to standards to substandards and then to the domains, and we're able to then certify the facility as compliant or non-compliant. Now, by complying with the measures that are set out in the standards, that is the evidence, We then will be able to say the risk of adverse events and clinical negligence will be reduced in that particular facility and will then certify it as compliant with the standards. We've got what we call functional areas so that honorable members follow. Basically, a functional area is more like a department in a health establishment. So we've got various functional areas for the hospitals, for the clinics, and for the community healthcare centers. I'm not going to go into detail on this, but just to demonstrate that the hospital functional areas, as I've said, that these would be different departments within an establishment. We've got non-clinical services and clinical services. Non-clinical functional areas would include management, administrative services, support services. The clinical services functional areas would include inpatient services, and these would be the different wards, medical, pediatric, and neonatal in hospitals. And then we also have the outpatient services, the clinic, and the clinical support services. Now we've got functional areas for hospitals. We've got functional areas for community health centers, and again, divided into non-clinical services and the clinical services, and that details some of the various departments that I have mentioned. And again, we do have functional areas for the clinics. Now, what happens once the inspection is finished? We then start to compile a report, and the report, we've got a standard technical report, a quality improvement template that we leave with the facility that will identify all those areas where the facility fell short, and they are then required to develop an improvement plan for themselves, which they can monitor. We'll also give them the evidence report and the functional area technical report. We do endeavor to always provide feedback to all the health establishments where we conduct the inspections. As per the new regulations, we are supposed to release a report within 20 days post the inspection to a health establishment, and we give them an opportunity to comment on the report, which takes another 20 days, and thereafter we produce the final report, and it takes us another 20 days. One critical function, or towards the end of any inspection, you should then be able to certify a health establishment as compliant or non-compliant. And then it brings us to the certification and enforcement actions of the Office of Health Standard Compliance. Now, the certification of health establishments, all those facilities that comply to the norms and standards get what we call a certificate of compliance. Now, this certificate of compliance is valid for a period of 4 years. Once a health establishment has a certificate of compliance, it does not necessarily mean that it cannot be revoked. In the event there is a serious breach in the norms and standards during that period, the office may conduct another inspection and we may suspend the certificate of compliance. When in the event you get a compliance notice, which I will explain, again, we will suspend the certificate of compliance because we can't give you a notice and you continue to be certified as being adherent to the norms and standards. Now, the renewal of this certificate of compliance is valid for 4 years, but 6 months before the expiry, the last year of the certificate of compliance, facilities can then request to extend the certificate of compliance. We can only extend for a period no longer than 1 year, so that we give ourselves time to go back and do and conduct another inspection. There's then, of course, requirements for the renewal. Amongst other things, okay, would be the administrative part of what form do you complete, but we also would want to know whether this facility has been conducting what we call or refer to as annual self-assessment. We recognize that we'll only inspect once in 4 years. But once we're not there, we want the facilities to continue to conduct self-assessment because, as you know, that quality is not a once-off event. It is a continuous process. So we will want to check and verify whether this health establishment has been conducting the self-assessment. And we'll want to also see the recent quality plan. We will take all of that and then determine that we will then extend the certificate of compliance for a period of a year. One critical link, honorable members, is this certificate of compliance, which I've just explained, with the link to the National Health Insurance funding. It is stipulated in the bill, the National Health Insurance Bill, that all healthcare establishments in this country, they need to have a certificate of compliance issued by the Office of Healthcare Standards Compliance before they can be accredited by the to participate in the NHI fund. So this is one critical and important factor which later on in the presentation I will refer to in as far as the operations and the constraints currently experienced by the office. So by law, we are supposed to certify all healthcare establishments that would want to participate in the NHI fund. All along, since the inception of the office, we have been using the national core standards from the National Department of Health, which were released in 2011 to conduct inspections. We took the national core standards, we then developed inspection tools. As of February of 2018, the Minister of Health promulgated the very first set of regulations, which then means the national core standards that we use as a transitionary measure by the office are no longer in use. As of February 2019, we are now using the regulations which are currently, which are already promulgated. So the certification that is going to be done by the office would be using these regulations. And also the complaints that will be that are investigated by the office and the ombud would also be using bridges in the norms as in the prescribed regulations. As I've mentioned that the office has enforcement powers, what is our approach? How do we enforce and why do we enforce? The reason why we enforce compliance, the bottom line is that we would want to encourage facilities to improve in quality. It's very important to understand enforcement as not being a punitive measure for facilities, but to really encourage them to reach a certain level of quality and safety for our healthcare users. So to that end, we've developed an enforcement policy which we consulted widely and broadly, both in the public and private healthcare sector, which was released for public comments and is now almost finalized. I talked about a compliance notice and I've explained what a certificate of compliance we've got the compliance notice and the certificate of compliance. So it's important to understand the difference and what is a compliance notice. When an inspector goes to a facility, if you are non-compliant and if there is persistent non-compliance, a compliance notice can be issued. And the purpose of a compliance notice is to inform the health establishment of any transgression in the norms and standards and give a health establishment an opportunity to comply. When we issue this compliance notice, it will have the details of the health establishment. It will also have the details of the prescribed norms and standards that have not been complied with. We will also explain the nature and the extent of the non-compliance and any steps that are required for that healthcare establishment to comply, as well as the period of time that we give them. Penalties that may be imposed in the event they do not adhere to the compliance notice. Why do we enforce compliance? As I have indicated that really it is to protect the healthcare users and to ensure that healthcare users receive the healthcare services that are of a suitable standard, and to hold the person responsible for a health facility in charge and accountable in ensuring that there is adherence to the regulations. Now, when you are going to undertake an enforcement action, it's important that you are guided by a particular criteria. And the office then will consider the following before we undertake an enforcement action. The criteria that we used before undertaking this action is that we'd want to know the adverse effect and the extent of the risk and how serious is that breach of in-depth norms and standards and what is the potential consequences of breaching those norms and standards. We also want to find out or consider the extent to which the person in charge or employees in that health establishment contributed in that breach. We'll also look at the compliance history of a health establishment and if there are any mitigating and aggravating factors and whether the breach is imminent. The aim of the enforcement criteria is also that we make sure that we use a standardized and a systematic way of determining whether we should enforce action if the breaches and norms and standards are serious and if there's non-adherence to the compliance notice. Honorable members, these are the enforcement actions, which are regulatory powers as they are stipulated in Section 82 of the Act. When there is persistent non-compliance, and I must qualify this, that enforcement action follows when there is persistent non-compliance. The office may issue a warning to the health establishment, and the warning would indicate the time frames by which you must adhere or remedy those breaches. We may request a written response from the person in charge, and again, we'll give them time frames. We may then recommend to the relevant authority, in this case, in the health establishment, it would be the HOD, the MEC, or the heads of the private healthcare sector. Our recommendation could be that disciplinary processes should actually follow when we feel that there is a serious breach in the norms and standards. We can revoke a certificate of compliance in the event we had issued it previously. We can also recommend to the Minister of Health to close parts or the entire facility. Let me qualify this. The Office of Health Standard Compliance does not have the power to close a section of a health establishment or to close a health establishment. The Office of Health Standard Compliance can only recommend to the Minister to do so and would provide the necessary information and motivation why we think that should be done. The Minister, and before we even go to the Minister, that would be also, will go through the OHSC board, and then the Minister will make a determination. The office can also issue a fine. The determination of the schedule of fines is first developed by the office, but then it is approved by the Minister through gazetting. In the event we feel that the breaches in those in the norms and standards tantamount to criminal activity, we can also refer to the relevant prosecuting authorities. Now, the two red circles, where we revoke a certificate of compliance when we had issued it, and where we recommend closure of an institution or part thereof, we must afford that health establishment a hearing. The hearing, the ad hoc tribunal is actually constituted by the CEO of the office, and we get someone, a presiding officer, that is not directly involved with the health establishment. Then we will consider the motivation and what also the recommendation from the presiding officer is. And the last red circle there, where it says the prosecution for offense are outlined in Section 89. The member said prosecution could be when there is criminal activity, but the Act goes further and details the following, or what I'm going to go through now, as also where we can then prosecute. If you obstruct or hinder an inspector in performing his or her duties, it is an offense. If you refuse to provide an inspector with the necessary information, it would be regarded as an offense. If you provide misleading information to an inspector or health officer, it's an offense. Or if you fail to comply with a compliance notice when it is issued by the Office of Healthcare Standards Compliance. The last bullet then pertains to us as the office. We cannot disclose any financial information that pertains to an individual in an institution to any third party. Similarly, the health establishment cannot disclose any personal information that is contained in the reports that we share with them either by the health ombud or the office. That would also be regarded as an offense. Any finding of the Office of Health Standards compliance is appealable. Any person aggrieved by the decision taken by the office has the right to appeal the decision within 30 days from the date of gaining the knowledge of that decision, and this appeal should be lodged directly with the Minister of Health and using the appropriate forms as in the Act, and the Minister will then formulate an ad hoc tribunal. We are required by the Act, again, Regulation 31, to publish any decisions of the ad hoc tribunal in the Gazette within 25 days. We also have to provide information that relate to certificates of compliance that the office has issued, the hearings that we have conducted, the recommendations that we have made. We should publish this within 6 months. I'm going to talk briefly about the complaints and investigations and the health ombudsman. I know that Prof will also discuss this as requested by the Honorable Chair. Currently, how the Act, Chapter 10 of the Act is structured is that the health ombudsman is within the Office of Health Standard Compliance. And the purpose of the complaints management and the ombudsman is to consider, investigate, and dispose of all the claims that we receive from the general public. This is not meant to replace the processes at facility level that seek to resolve complaints. Now, functionally, the ombudsman is located within the strategic objectives and the indicators, as you would see when we present our annual performance plan. The office has the responsibility to provide assistance and resources to the ombudsman, as it is again mentioned in Section 81 of the Act. What happens when these complaints arrive? We have a call center that was launched in November of 2016. They go to the complaints center. At this point, they're filtered. They could be referred to other relevant authorities, or they are sent for further assessment. They can be resolved during assessment, or they can be then referred for further investigation if it is a complex case, or if the team feels that there's much more information that is needed. The OMBUD works with the clinical and legal team that conducts the investigations and deal with the complaints, and the OMBUD makes the finding and recommend the actions to be taken. Once the OMBUD has recommended the actions to be taken, that report is then tabled to the CEO of the OHSC, who then should monitor implementation of these recommendations. The investigation process, I'm not going to go through it in detail, but just to indicate that the team will draw up an investigation plan, share it with the facility, and once they get to the facility, they'll gather the information through some of the methodologies that I've explained previously, face-to-face interviews, observations, and photographic evidence. Then there'll be a process of evaluating the information received. And during this period, there could definitely be assistance or involvement of experts within that particular field. And we do, again, provide an opportunity for the health establishment to give comments in the preliminary report before the final report is issued. Communication and stakeholder engagement, most of the work that we do, and being a new player in the regulatory space, particularly in the healthcare sector, it is very important that we conduct in-depth communication and stakeholder engagement so that the general public, the healthcare workers, could understand, and also other regulatory entities could have a better understanding of what the office does and what is our mandate and how do we function. We have done this ever since the office was established, and through consultative workshops and through collaboration with various key stakeholders. And we have been to all the provinces, and we do conduct these campaigns or information sharing in the office, in our health establishment, and we do reach out to communities. We sought to go to, you know, the rural areas in the past 2 years so that we can ensure that our people understand the mandate of the office and they know what are the services that are offered by the office as well as the ombuds. And this is just a pictorial depiction of some of the places that the office has been to. Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, I'm now about to proceed to the annual performance plan.
Look, I wanted just to check if we could pause here on this one and make this as a third part and maybe now get into the ombud.
Thank you, Chair and Honorable Members. First of all, I must apologize for having taught Dr. Lomo. Maybe I made a mistake. I should not have passed him. But I think he and I go a long way. And thank you for the opportunity, as I say, to make comments. I was only told, I think yesterday or so, that I should make myself available here. But I just want to make a few comments that are positive and a few that are very difficult. First of all, there will never be another life as demanding. I've gone through the medical literature. It has never occurred. It's not there, and it will never be there. I think this was a very special aberration, and I think it has received the special attention that it needed to. It's going to be with us for a long time. That's why I think things have not been resolved. But to cut the long story short, honorable members, there is an explosion of mental health throughout the world. Most of you would remember that when we had an explosion of AIDS, we had something called SANAC in the country. And I have tried to encourage people in this field to establish a committee to focus on mental health, to advise the minister and to advise parliament. I see this particularly in South Africa because we have had 367 years of trauma through colonialism, through apartheid, and it has created all kinds of mental health scenarios. At the moment, we have got one of the highest gender-based violence in the world. We never related to the trauma we have suffered, the neglect we have given to our children, the socialization that we have incurred. We have the highest levels of crime. All of these things relate to the way we are socialized. And we tend to think that this is normal. So our point of reference of normality is very different from the rest of the world. And we are not giving this attention. I think as parliamentarians, people with oversight, I want to leave you with this message that there is an epidemic of mental health throughout the world. I think we better wake up, and we have a reason to actually pay much more attention because of our history. I know that the former British Prime Minister May had taken mental health as her objective. The Canadian Prime Minister has done the same thing. I think about 30 European countries have all looked at the epidemic of mental health in their country. It's all going up. And I think in South Africa we need to pay attention to that. I want to pause here on the mental health issue and then just comment on what my colleague Dr. Ndaweni has said about the OHSC. I think from listening to her, you can see how broad and wide the mandate of the OHSC is. Just in terms of inspection alone, it's a task that could be given to an organization. Because you've got to inspect, you've got to monitor, you've got to regulate. This is a huge mandate. Now you've got to certify, later on you've got to develop the norms and standards. And then you have this little afterthought called the ombud. Just to point a few anomalies, the OHSC operates through the board that is chaired by Audrey, and then it goes to the minister. I operate directly through to the minister. I have very little to do with the board. I mean, that's an anomaly. I have to deal with complaints and investigate. Quite often in my investigations, I need experts. If I've got a neurological problem, I cannot use an investigator, for example, within the OHSC. I need a top-class neurology because my findings are subject to review, they are subject to challenges, and that often requires high-level expertise. So just looking at the contradictions of what the OMBU does and what the OHSC does tells you that there are two separate mandates, I think, that needs to be handled in a particular way. Unfortunately, in South Africa, you've got something called Poikikos. I think you tried to create a Poikikos. It's a very bad one. By bringing these two offices in the way that you've done it, we, together, I think, with Dr. Mbaweni and her predecessor, we've tried to work very well in order to salvage a very difficult situation. There are too many contradictions. On the one hand, Parliament expects me to be independent. But I am a program of another project in the OHSC. How can I be independent? Parliament expects me to be independent. I report to the minister. How can I be independent? So there are these contradictions that were created in the Act that are... Now, if you look at the offices of OMBUDS throughout the world, they deal with maladministration in health. And I use this word maladministration because health is not located in establishments. Health takes place in society. So that's the first mistake you've got to unpack, that health in society takes place in society, not in establishments. Life as a Dimeni, for example, there was no establishment. Life as a Dimeni had no norms and standards. So immediately, the biggest investigation I had to do did not fall within the parameters of what was in the Act, except there was a little window of opportunity that says, if there is a situation within the health system that impacts and the health ombud sees that it is necessary to investigate, he should take the initiative to do so. It's somewhere in the small print of the Act. And that's the window that allowed us to be able to investigate the life as a Dimeni. Because otherwise, smart lawyers would say, but there were no nonsense standards here, so why did you go there? There was no establishment here. There was a department of health in Gauteng. So I think what I'm trying to get at is this, that the office of the health ombud, since its establishment around 1809 in Scandinavia, looks at maladministration in health, irrespective of norms and standards. You don't ignore them, but they don't become your primary objective in order to set up this office. And as I say, what we have been struggling with Dr. Mdawane, I'll give you a very simple example. Supposing that it says that the Office of Health Inspectorate can help me investigate. If the inspectors are needed in the OHSC to do their job, who has priority? Is it the ombud or is it the OHSC? Because I don't have staff. But again, I'm coming back to Parliament. This is the third time I'm here. I have made this argument before, that I think we need to put to bed the legislative contradictions and conflicts, and I think set up the office such that It operates like all offices of Ombuds. It can relate with the OHSC, but find a way that I think is very sound and ethical in the way we can do things. As I say, I work very well, and we work very well with Dr. Mdaweni. We don't have problems with that. At the moment, and I want to make this very brief, I applied to join the International Office of Ombuds Institute. And you know what were the questions I had to ask? Are you independent? How can you be independent if you are reporting to the minister? Because all offices of ombuds in the world, they report to parliament directly. They don't report to ministers. They report to parliament, like here. And it was discussed here, but it was thrown out there for whatever reasons. But anyway, so you are not independent. How can you be independent if you are a program of another structure? So this whole issue of how I think we have come about, I believe that as parliament you now have an answer, because the presidential health summit debated this issue and has come to the conclusion that yes, I think you need to do something about these two offices. You need to provide clarity on this independence and its staff. The Office of Public Service Administration has approved a structure and has costed that. And all of these issues are things that maybe in the sixth administration, because the fifth one failed and nearly messed us up, but let's not go there. I think we can forgive them because we are a forgiving nation. But let's not, this sixth administration has to do something. We can't perpetuate to be in a mess continuously. And every time we forgive each other. And I will tell you, the classic example of this came when I was investigating life as a Dimeni, where some of the so-called people that I did find had made some misdemeanors, kept on saying to me, why do you want to make examples of us? Because there are other bigger fishes that are messing up the country and you're not doing anything about it. So I think let's just, let me pause here. And as I say, I think we have worked together, we will continue to work together in the circumstances that we have. But really, let's go back to the foundations. In fact, in my own sort of like isolation, I have often wondered whether the people who were drawing up this were just using cut and paste, or, you know, it was monks trying to come up with a military plan to go and fight a war. So they didn't know what they were doing. And as Jesus Christ said when he was on the cross, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they did. They didn't know what they were doing. That's all. Thank you.
May I request, honorable members, you would recall that this matter came in our legacy report. Before we make pronouncements as this committee, we will be appraised very well by people like Honorable Wilson, who were in the previous administration, but also get the minister to share with us a way forward. Because if you pick up an anomaly before we could actually make pronouncements on it ourselves, let us get to understand. I wanted just to say, Honorable members, it was important for what we read in our legal research report regarding this matter that Professor Makgoba comes to actually expand on it. But we do not necessarily go into discussion before we can engage with the department in it. I might actually admit in my other life where this matter was tabled, I could have been part of endorsing it. But the nitty-gritty now, as we go forward on operations, you could pick up challenges. May I request, honorable members, that maybe we do not get into that part now. But thank him for clarifying these issues and then on those processes. If that is allowed, could then we take the annual performance plan and then to combine them together? If that is allowed, honourable members, let us then say what Professor Makhoba said is our food for thought, provision to sort it out elsewhere, but allow to come down to continue now with the annual performance plan, and therefore we'll do it together. And we are happy that we waited for Honourable Wilson to join us for the annual performance plan. Thanks that you have been able to sort out the challenges that you faced. Continue, Dr. Ndaweni.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Just as way of background in the development of the annual performance plan for 2019-20, the OHSC board in the first couple of years of the existence of the organization adopted broad strategies which really were all designed to assist the office to achieve its legislative mandate. Among those broad strategies were a deliberate effort to actually reach those facilities that serve the most disadvantaged and those facilities that were not performing very well in as far as quality and safety is concerned, so that they can be lifted to quality healthcare services. And some of those strategies included the capacity building of office staff and creating platforms to better interact with various stakeholders, and also using information that is gathered during inspections to inform decision making. Now, taking into consideration all those broad strategies, they were all distilled into the strategic outcome-oriented goals, which I'm going to read out only. I am going to go into the detail of the indicators that are mentioned below. The first strategic outcome goal for the office is to publicly demonstrate responsiveness and accountability as an effective and efficient high-performance organization. Goal 2, to inspect health establishments for compliance with quality norms and standards. Goal 3, patient and community complaints regarding poor care and situations of concern be investigated and responded to timelessly. Goal 4, being the progressively improve the quality and safety of healthcare through effective communication and collaboration with users and other stakeholders, including the providers. Now, the organogram as it stands in the APP of 2019-20, Professor Makhoba has explained that as the ombuds, he reports directly to the minister. The OHSC board, as the accounting authority of the organization, reports to the minister, then the CEO, and then we've got the four programs which I am going to go into detail when I discuss the APP targets. Now, part A of the strategic overview, we'll then look at what situations did we consider, or our environment which we operate in when we were crafting the annual performance plan. Our situational analysis then was really focused, as I've indicated, in putting systems in place. And during the financial year 2018-19, the minister promulgated the norms and standards for different categories of healthcare different categories of healthcare institutions. Now, this was quite important because it meant for the first time the Office of Health Standard Compliance will then be able to conduct inspections not only in the public sector but also in the private sector. Honourable members have heard Professor Makhoba mentioning that the lawyers, if we go without the regulations, they will then ask that which norms and standards are you using, because you don't have this promulgated as regulations. But moving forward and starting from this financial year, we'll be able to do so. We also looked at the revised strategic plan for medium-term strategic framework of 2015-16. And based on our experience in implementation, we then introduced revised goals for the program of complaints management and the health ombuds, which I will go through later on. We continuously monitor, you know, the life asset demand report recommendations by the health ombuds. I think, as mentioned by the Honourable Chairperson, these recommendations are not a once-off, so the office has a responsibility to ensure that we constantly engage all the role players and the stakeholders in ensuring that we hold them accountable to what the ombud had recommended. In August of 2018, the ombud released an investigation report into allegations of patient mismanagement and patient rights violations at Tower Psychiatric Hospital, which was also out in the public domain. Now, we are very much aware that improving quality of health is a critical component of the National Development Plan
outcome, which is to strengthen the health system effectiveness. And this we will then do through the external compliance, which using the prescribed norms and standards. We think that what with the promulgated norms and standards and TAMA's resolution of complaints and investigations received by the OHSC, will be able to contribute towards improving the healthcare system effectiveness. I must, however, mention that all of this, what is critically linked to it, are the resources that are available to undertake all these tasks. We also looked at the performance delivery environment, and this again, it related to the performance as you know, it was looked at by the Auditor General, and we tried very much to incorporate some of the comments which we received from the Auditor General. And the existence of systems and processes in other areas, currently we have everything that we probably need for a functional office. But you will see as I go through the presentation that where we actually lack is in making sure that we follow through with the core activities of the office. Our organizational environment did not change much except from what I have explained as the promulgation of the regulations. What is then meant, and once these are promulgated, we all have a period of 1 year to prepare the health establishment, to prepare as an office. So we had to adapt the inspection tools to be aligned to the regulations and no longer use the national core standards. We had to retrain the inspectors with training that is also aligned to the regulations, and we will then be conducting these inspections in the private sector. We've also observed an exponential increase in the number of complaints that are received as a result of the life epidemic. I think we'll all agree that it is one report that is constantly quoted almost on a daily basis in our country. So we saw this upwards, I think, movement in as far as people that come to the office to lodge complaints and the various platforms which, in which we receive these complaints. Now, due to our limited funding envelope, it is not possible for the office to undertake these inspections, both in the public and private sector, to resolve these complaints and conduct these investigations to an extent that we'd be comfortable that we are reaching our legislative mandate. And this is one area which is of major concern to us. As much as we now have to expand, we have to do more inspections in the public sector, we have to go to the private sector, but we still have the limited funds. And you will see in our target the implications thereof. And I think we'd want to bring this to the attention of the honorable members that until such time that this is really taken care of, it is going to defeat us in actually achieving what we are supposed to achieve as an office. The other legislative mandates that came into being which have a direct impact in the work of the office would be the National Health Insurance Bill and the Council for Medical Schemes Amendment Bill. I'm now going to take honorable members through Section B of the APP. We're now going to look at all the four programs of the organization, starting with Program 1, which is administration. Within Program 1, we've got corporate services, we've got communication, information technology, all the board activities and the office of the CEO. And the purpose of this program is to provide leadership and administrative support as necessary to deliver on the core mandate and other relevant legislative requirements. So I now take you through the indicators. I am going to focus on what is in our strategic plan, which comes to an end at the end of this financial year. I will also look at the audited performance. I will look at the target for 2018-19 and will then focus more on 2019-20. For Program 1, the first strategic objective, which is to establish a fully functional office suitably staffed to execute the mandate and goals of the office. We had an indicator because we're starting off in this strategic plan of a percentage of funded staff that is appointed by the office. The strategic plan target is 93, was 90. The audited performance for 17-18 were able to exceed this target at 93%. We have a target of 90 funded staff appointed for 18-19. We have maintained 90 for also 2019-20. We have done pretty well in as far as, you know, getting the staff within the budget that we have. But I will demonstrate as we go along some of the challenges that we are experiencing. The second strategic objective is to accredit inspectors after successfully completing approved training course. This is very fundamental to the work of the office that all our inspectors are compliant. The indicator thereof is the percentage of compliance inspectors that are accredited. The strategic plan target was 100%. Our audited performance for 2017-18 was zero. This does not mean our inspectors are not trained. And I need to explain this. Our inspectors were trained before they went and conducted inspections. I then said, honorable members, in February of 2018, we then had the promulgation of the regulations. What it then meant is that we needed to align the training to the regulations, which is why we are at zero. But they were trained. Now, for 18-19, we have a target of 85%, and for 19-20, we have a target of 90%. At the moment, all our inspectors have been trained with the training curriculum by one of the tertiary institutions. Of course, we went through a normal procurement processes, and they are appointed as inspectors. The third strategic objective, to implement good governance, oversight, and accountability through appropriate delegations, including financial management, and the indicator is the Auditor General's annual findings ratings. We're very pleased to announce to honorable members that since the start of the office, we've been able to obtain an unqualified audit, and we are hoping and working hard that again for 2019-20 and the subsequent years, we'll be able to maintain that. Strategic objective 1.4, to leverage the information technology to meet the needs of the organization. Here we put an indicator of the percentage of IT system uptime. When the office moved or was detached from the Department of Health, we launched in the offices of the Medical Research Council. We were then using some of their infrastructure in as far as IT is concerned. Recently, at the beginning of this year, the office has moved to new premises. So for the strategic plan, of course, we put 95% because we would want we are a data-driven organization in the main. The audited performance for 17-18 was 99%. For 18-19, we had a target of 95%. For 19-20, the current APP, we've put 80%. We are not necessarily decreasing this target, but we're very cognizant of the fact that where we are now, we have to start the IT infrastructure from scratch. There's actually nothing. We need to start all of that. Whereas in the previous years, we were able to leverage on what the Medical Research Council had, and it was a bit easier for us. This is also one component which needs funds, which we don't have much of, so that we can be able to support adequately the core activities of the office. To create a public provider and stakeholder awareness about the roles and powers of the OSC, of the OHSC, this indicator here, we track the number of media events, communication, and stakeholder events that the office undertakes during the whole year. The strategic plan, we had a target of 18. Our audited performance was 8. We did reach this target. For 18-19, we have a target of 8. We are aware that we are going to do more of this. In fact, we need to do more of this, but then we put a target of 12 because of what you know we have available. It's very important that we sign cooperative agreements with some of the stakeholders that are in the regulatory space and that work close with us. And for 19-20, we have put a target of 2 MOUs. We will come in the nearest, possible future to give our performance for 18-19. So that will take care of the first program. The second program, which is a compliance inspectorate certification and enforcement. This would comprise of most of OHSC staff because this is where the inspectors are. And the program purpose is to manage inspections in health establishments from planning up until the certification, as well as the taking of the enforcement action against those facilities that are non-compliant. When you go through the indicators in our APP, the strategic objectives, the first one, 2.1, relate to the inspections that are conducted both in the public and the private sector. For all these years, we've always had one target, which was the inspections conducted in the public sector, which is the first one, the number and percentage of public healthcare establishments inspected. For the strategic plan, we had a target of 20%. Our audited performance was 24.1. We exceeded the target. For 2018-19, we aimed to conduct 725. We have done so. We'll come back and report on this in our annual report. For 19-20, I want honorable members to note that going down, we've put a target of 687 of the 3,816 public health care sector establishments. Now, the reason being, we had to accommodate the private sector. The 725 was not enough, but we had to then reduce this target so that at least we can conduct some inspections in the private sector, which is the second indicator. Although we have a strategic plan target of 30%, for 1920, out of the 393 private healthcare sector establishments in our database, we are going to conduct 24 inspections. Already when we look at these figures and we look at the vastness of the mandate and the coverage both in the public and private healthcare sector, we then realize that we are going to have challenges. As we speak for this current financial year, we are experiencing very serious constraints in as far as carrying out the inspections and with the target that we have put. The second strategic objective, to certify health establishments that are compliant with prescribed norms and standards. Now, this is where we issue the certificates of compliance. So we started off with the development of procedures, which was our indicator, and we have developed these procedures. Members may ask that why did we not have a target for 2018-19? It's because we already had a draft of the certification procedures, but we had to wait for the promulgation of the regulations before we can finalize. So what we were busy with was just widespread consultation both in the public and private healthcare sector. So for 2019-20, our target is the certification procedures developed and finalized because we now have the regulations. And we have moved with that as well. Of course, we would want all healthcare establishments that we have certified as compliant after an inspection to be issued with a certificate of compliance. With this one, we can't have any other target except for 100% of those that are compliant to be given certificates. Now, with limited resources, one of our risks as an office is not to delay in issuing the certificate of compliance, more so if we say it is a precursor to participate in the NHI fund. So this is one, I think, issue we also need to be, that we are bearing in mind and we're bringing to the honorable members in as far as resources are concerned. The enforcement action will be guided by an enforcement policy and procedures. We started by developing that. And again, we waited for the promulgation of the regulations. We do have the enforcement policy in place. We have consulted. It was out for public comment. And it will, as we continue with our work, we will start to take enforcement action where we think there is a persistent non-compliance. Now, the next indicator will talk to that percentage of non-compliant health establishment for which enforcement action is initiated within 10 days of the date of receipt for a risk inspection report. What it means is that when there is non-compliance, you cannot wait. There will be instances where inspectors would give a notice immediately because it would be maybe a danger to the healthcare establishment. But what our indicator here, similarly with the compliance certificate, was saying where we must take action, all those as health establishments, all 100% of them, or whatever number that we feel that we should take action, we should be able to do so. We are required to publish information about the compliance status of health establishment with the regulations or with the norms and standards. Our indicator is the number of reports on inspections that are conducted and the remedial recommendations that we provide as an office. For the strategic plan, we have a target of 5, which means each year we will always produce an annual inspection report, which we disseminate to the general public and to everyone and all our stakeholders. That brings us to the end of the target for Program 2. We then proceed to Program 3, which is complaints management and the health ombuds. I have mentioned, I'm not going to go through what we've already discussed in as far as how we interact and relate with the health ombuds and the purpose of the program which we have indicated, which is to dispose complaints relating to non-compliance with prescribed norms and standards. Now, when we look at this, the strategic objective, the first one, an accessible mechanism by which complaints can be lodged with the office. The Complaints Management Unit was established in 2015. So the first thing, and which is why this was put as an indicator in the strategic plan, was to find a platform and a measure of how are we going to receive these complaints, which was a fully functional call center for receiving complaints. And this, I think the wording in your document might be just slightly different, but it's the availability and the establishment of a call center. And this was done, we do have a fully functional call center. So this is one of the indicators in our new strategic plan is going to fall off because it is now obsolete. We already have the call center functioning. The second strategic objective to investigate and respond to complaints about non-compliance with norms and standards effectively. Now, the first indicator, the percentage of low-risk complaints that are resolved in the call center within 2 months. When the team receive these complaints, they will go through a complaints assessment metrics, and they will then be categorized as low risk, medium risk, high risk, or extreme. Now, we put an indicator of the low risk complaints here that are resolved within a period of 2 months. We did not have this in the strategic plan, as I've indicated that this program was established in 2015. So this is a new indicator in 2017-18. For 2018-19, we have a target of 50%. For 2019-20, we have a target of 60. We have since re-looked at these percentages, and I do wish to report to honorable members that in your books or documents, you would have 70%. We've revised this to 75% because we looked at our performance over time. But I must indicate that in this program, one big risk to the public and also to the integrity of the program and the office and the health ombud is if we fail to timelessly deal with the complaints that the office receives. And in the moment, with the staff complement that we have, at some point that is going to happen. It is already happening, and it is something that we wish to bring to the attention of the honorable members. The second indicator is the percentage of user complaints that are resolved within 30 working days through assessment and screening. Now, you've got those ones that are resolved in the call center. This is also a new indicator. So through assessment and screening, some of these can be resolved. For 2018-19, we have a target of 50%. 19-20, we put a target of 30% because we realized that because of the shortages in staff, we're unable to actually reach this target. And we have also reduced it to 35% for 2020, and I think you had a 45% in your documents. I'm going to the next two indicators. I'll read the first one. Percentage complaints lodged with the OHSC investigated and responded to within 6 months. We had a strategic plan target of 80%. Our audited performance was 38.2%, and really we fell short because we just did not have adequate resources. For 2018-19, we had 80%. Now, let me explain why we don't have targets for 2019-20 and moving forward. The indicator just below replaces the one above. It then reads percentage complaints received for investigation and responded to within 6 months. Now, we are informed by the Auditor General that once we've put a target in the strategic plan, you can't just remove it. But this one below, what it means, and really this is based on our experience, is that the 6 months all along we would count investigations that arrived at the time that that complaint was lodged, and then we start calculating the 6 months. But this indicator and how we are going to describe it in the indicator protocol sheet is that we will start counting the 6 months at the time that a complaint is referred to the investigation unit. So that time when it's with the investigation unit, we then start counting the 6 months, which then replaces the one above, which was starting to count the 6 months when we received the complaint. And we realize that it is not feasible, because most of the time when the investigators and the team go through all of this information, we are dependent on information that we request from health establishments. We are dependent on trying to find the people that lodged the complaint. So we have then tried to align this with our experience on the ground. And the indicators is indicate for the targets for 2019-20 is 40, 45, and 55. Now, the next strategic objective, issue findings and recommendations about complaints of non-compliance with prescribed norms and standards within 6 months. Here we needed a system and procedures for investigation of complaints set up. This one is also absolute, because this was achieved. And the next one, the percentage of investigation finalized within 6 months by the ombud. As we implement and as we gain more experience, we then realize some of the things the manner in which we had crafted the indicators was a bit confusing. Now, I take you back to the indicator that I've explained in 3.2, the last row, which is complaints received for investigation and responded to within 6 months. This indicator is exactly the same as the percentage of investigation finalized within 6 months by the ombud, because the very same team that works with the ombud is it's just one team. So we can't have an indicator that will say finalized by the ombud and finalized by investigation, because the investigation unit in itself lies within the health ombud. So this was a matter of how the indicator was crafted, which is why we also have we did not put any targets, but we have maintained it and we'll still be reporting it on it in 3.2, the last row. 3.4, the communicate and monitor recommendations made by the ombud. Again, the last we needed to have the procedures for communication, and that has already been done. It is functional. Now, the indicator is the percentage of ombud recommendations monitored for implementation by health establishments within 6 months of tabling to the OHSC. That indicator has also been refined as the one just below it, that these are the ombud recommendations monitored for implementation within 6 months of tabling to the OHSC. Honourable members will recall that I said the reports that the ombud releases, they come to the OHSC for monitoring. So we also learned through experience that we needed to clarify what exactly this indicator means. So we have retained it, but we have made sure that it is much clearer that it is the OHSC CEO that would be monitoring this. And for 2019-20, we put a target of 85%. Although we have 85%, it does not mean that we do not follow all of the recommendations. But what it means is that some of them always would overlap into the subsequent financial year, and we've put 95% and 100%. Again, here is an issue of the financial constraints, which I have alluded to earlier. The last program, Program 4, which is Health Standard Design, Analysis and Support. This is the program that would develop the standards, that would provide support to the health establishment on the standards, and also would conduct research and conduct more in-depth analysis of the inspection findings and the reports. The indicators thereof, the strategic ones, the first one, all health establishments are obligated to submit annual returns. Now, the annual returns is what we use to profile the health establishment. So all health establishments should submit annual returns to us. You will recall when I was discussing the extension of the certificate of compliance, that we will also look as to whether were you submitting annual returns, because then we're able to profile it and have a better understanding of a health establishment. So the system is fully functional. We have this indicator has fallen off as well. Then the next one, the percentage of annual returns that are analyzed within 60 days to determine the profiles of the health establishment. We have a strategic plan target of 80%. For 1920, we've maintained 80%. With this one, it's very important that we analyze this information and we go back to the facilities and share with them. And this is where we're also able to see as an organization issues that relate maybe to human resources in relation to their budgetary expenditures, and we're able to give them, and then we discuss that with the health establishment. Now, in the past, we only had this for the public sector. The next indicator is indicated as new. It is exactly the same, except that we'll now be doing, we'll be analyzing the annual returns for the private sector. The norms and standards that we develop and recommend to the minister, we have a strategic plan of 3. We have been able to achieve this target by at least once a year. We do submit a set of norms and standards for the consideration by the minister. Thus far, we have the ones that have been promulgated. We have submitted 2 other sets, which are standards for general practice, which will be applicable to the general practitioners. We've also submitted a standard for emergency medical services. We did not put a target for 2019-20 because we now know that it's quite a lengthy process to get to a stage where norms and standards are promulgated as regulations, and there's quite a lot of work that the office will have to do with regards to the 2 sets which have been submitted, and we are aware that the minister and the team are actually looking into the general practice standards, which will probably be promulgated soon. We, as explained, are required to meet with relevant authorities responsible for health establishments and support them and provide them with guidance for compliance with norms and standards. Here we try to meet the big bodies so that they can be able to disseminate the training to others. For 2019-20, we have a target of 14 staff institutions that we will meet with and give and provide guidance and the necessary material to assist them in complying with the norms and standards. We refer to the early warning system, which is a risk-based system. Now, we use this to also assist us to prioritize inspections. Now, we needed to develop a system that would be able to get us to be in touch with all healthcare establishments. I must mention that we have started with the work, but it's still a long way to go because of some of the, I think now I'm going to start to sound like a broken record, I'm going to talk about the financial constraints again, but we have started the preliminary work. But what is important here is to know that we have to actually link with all the healthcare establishments in the country, both public and private, so that when there is an indicator of risk, they can be able to report to us immediately and we can be able to follow up and find out what has the establishment done. Because what's important about these indicators of risk is not so much so to respond to the Office of Health Standards Compliance, but most importantly is to alert the facility of imminent danger so that they act on it. And by the time we get to know about it, we also want to know that how did you respond to this imminent danger. So we have a system, but still at its nascent phase. And then it may happen that during this, we'll then feel that it's a serious risk, and we can use that information to then conduct an inspection. Now, we call those high-risk health establishments. Now, those high-risk health establishments, we want to inspect all of them. We will make a determination whether we should actually conduct an inspection, or we will then say perhaps we are satisfied that the health establishment has adequately responded to the imminent risk. That, honorable members, brings us to the end of program 4, and I'm going to request our CEO, honorable chair, to take us through the financials.
Hey, it's a long one. I'll only give you 5 minutes because, members, there's lunch outside. It's getting cool. It's going to be very cold, and then we'll come back for questions after that lunch. That's a challenge. I'm standing between your lunch getting cold because we're going to grab it and still come back. But I'll push the CFO.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Good afternoon, also Honorable Members. I'll briefly take the members through the budget. This slide shows the allocation that has been made to the OHSC for the medium term. For the 1920 financial year, we're working at 136 million. This is better explained by the next slide. In terms of this,
you have this, Honourable Members, on your presentation. You have copies, hard copies of this. Yeah.
This slide shows that basically there are three main cost elements which are larger. The first one is compensation of employees because of the nature of the organization being a service organization which relies on staff members to deliver. And the second one is traveling, subsistence and accommodation, which is about the inspectors, largely inspectors traveling throughout the country. And the third one is the issue of office space. Members will notice that in the 17-18 financial year, the cost was 2.4 million. Simply because we were occupying 1,000 square meters at the MRC offices, about 140 employees and furniture, all cramped in one space. Now we've moved into our new premises, and the lease payments as well as IT systems and servers have taken that cost high. And this has resulted in variable cost of traveling going down here, because now some of the costs have gone into the issue of office space. And as the CEO has indicated, this now affects the targets that we set over the MTF period because of this difference here. And we will see that in terms of the overall budget, the budget of the OHSC has been increasing by an average of 5% per year. And the costs have been increasing by an average of about 8%. Because the OHSC uses the same remuneration system as that of the DPSA. So there's a difference. The costs are outgrowing the budget. And the only way we could have managed this was to go and cut on traveling, which, as I said, affects now the target that we set, because that's the only variable cost we could manage to go to. And in terms of allocation per division, we realize that the inspectorate is the one that has got the highest at 36% of the budget. And corporate services has gone up because of the reason I mentioned, the issue of office space now taking center stage. And the next slide actually also confirms that. But in terms of core functions versus support functions, 58% goes to core functions, and 42% goes to support function. The core functions is the inspectorate, complaints, and the standards development function, which the CEO has already alluded to. And I'll not explain this one. This slide is better explained by the next one, that half the OHSC is the inspectors. 50% are in the inspectorate. 26% are in administration. Administration is the CEO's office, the HR, IT, finance, communication, and stakeholder relations. So combined, on a combined basis, 74% of staff are in the core functions, with 26% in support functions. And then in terms of economic classification, as I've indicated, 68% of the cost is compensation of employees because of the nature of the work that we do, whereas goods and services make up 28%, capital expenditure is just 1% of the cost. So the almost two-thirds of the cost is compensation of employees, with half of that going to the inspectorate. And so here we just an explanation of the issues that I've already raised for members to know that while the budget is increasing by an average of 5%, compensation has grown by an average of 8%. And these compensation percentages, we use the exact ones which the National Treasury provides over the years through the MTF guidelines. So it's the same percentage raise that we get there. So this creates a disparity in terms of target setting, as well as the cost related, which are required to be able to meet the targets. And this is a continuation of the other slides that I've already explained. The staff complement is 125 currently, and with half of that being in the inspectorate. And that was the last slide. Thank you, Honorable Chair. Thanks, Honorable Members.
Honorable Members, I'd like you to go 2:45 to the plenary. So there's a 20-minute break to get our lunch, come back, and deal with the matter. So can we break for 20 minutes only? So it means you are back here. What time is this now? We are back to 10 to 2. Yeah. Grab whatever we have outside. 2:45, we are back to deal with the questions. Please be thinking about what you would like to raise.
Remain on our agenda until it's resolved. Second thing, that let me welcome this organization, led a powerful woman, chairperson a woman, and also CEO a woman. Encouraged, and it was a powerful presentation. But the key issues that it's an advice perhaps that you may have to consider. You may have what you call, after your team have certified, to have what you call continuous monitoring. You may have what you call monitoring, which is intelligence-led, which can be able to monitor real-time. Because if you have two more inspectors, you close the company. You have no money to have this system to be sustainable. Big data, one of the key issues to consider, in my view. But after all, the rest of the thing, Chairperson, we can take them forward. It's not one-day issues. We can take them forward broadly as we look at the institution of the department as a whole. And I'm sure at some point we'll have to conduct some what called the visit to these various institutions that are presented before us. Thanks.
Increase
for budget is very important for this institution. 5%, it doesn't look good for them.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to know how much time do I have? What can I get? Sure. Okay. First of all, thank you for having an ombudsman here today and putting the matter of life estimating back on the agenda. I appreciate it. I said very much. It's a matter which we cannot leave behind. We must go forward on it. And I'm looking forward to the next. But I will run through this as quickly as possible, if you allow me, Chair. I just want to get clarity, and this is clarity questions. Maybe you have provided for answers, but please help me in all of these manners. I want to talk on to your mandate. Can you please help me understand what do you see your mandate is? If your mandate comply with state hospitals and clinics, I'm asking this question because many of these institutions are in a very terrible state. And what are you doing to rectify this and your main problem that is going on currently in our state hospitals and clinics? On slide 7, I just want to have clarity. Do you do inspections on a regularly basis at these institutions? And what do you see as a regularly basis? And the other thing I can't understand is how can these state institutions be certified if it's in such a terrible state? And I also want to know how many hospitals and clinic certifications has been withdrawn in the last financial year. On slide 10, how many accountability actions were done the last financial year? We see in the news the assault of patients by state hospital nurses and other workers and so on and so on. And I think it's a big problem which is currently underway in our state institutions. On slide 13, I just want to know how many inspectors are currently in service. On 14, 15, and 16, I just want to know if a report is available of recent inspections throughout South Africa's state hospitals and clinics. And if so, can we be provided with such a report? And also on 29 August, last week, it was reported in the media that all of Gauteng state hospitals and clinics failed a safety audit. Is the safety audit also falling under your mandate? Okay, this one I'm going to skip. I just want to know, in slide 29, how many state hospitals and clinics do not comply? And the last one on slide 30, what will happen in the event if a state hospital and clinic do not comply when the NHI will be launched? Thank you, Chair.
Long list, good, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. To the board and the CEO, thank you for the presentation. I was there in 2011 when this whole thing started, and in 2012, etc. To see where you've come now, that we've now moved from norms and standards to regulations as promulgated at February 2019, I think we all understand the importance of this organization that you represent. The question is just how are you going to do this, because we also see the difficulties in your presentation. We see your challenges, practical challenges. We also see the challenges of the ombud. And then we thirdly see the challenges in terms of the finances. If I look at your slide, the slide does not have a number, that means it would be 58. If I look at you having to do your inspections and then your certifications, etc., and I look at your percentages which you put there, your projections of 18% and 18% and the numbers there, then it tells me that we are not actually really going to get there, that something is creating a stumbling block for you to get there. And maybe you need to make us clearly understand that a bit better. I would assume that would be in terms of funding and having to fill all the posts and having to probably optimize your functioning. So that's the only question that I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I just would like to, my first point is on the mandate of the OHSC, specifically because it's stated that you protect the states, South Africa, responsible to protect citizens from harm. But according to the vision, it's safe and quality healthcare for all South Africans. My question is, in South Africa, it's not only South Africans who are staying here, who need health care. So it obviously means the vision here, it's not inclusive of all those who are staying in Africa, all Africans, as it may be. I just want to ask whether there's a possibility that there can be inclusion of others that are staying in South Africa as our country. The second one is about the discouragement and penalized, the slide 10 that talks about the penalizing and the abuse of power, negligence, slide 10. And then I just would like to ask, in the cases that you received in your department, there was a case of a lady that was tied on a chair in one of the Mamelodi hospitals, an old lady for that matter. Did you receive such a case, and how did you handle it? Because it has got an impact on the personnel in the hospitals itself, that says that there is obviously a problem in that particular hospital, because we are dealing with the standards and compliance of the hospital together with the clinic, inclusive of the case, and I'm just repeating the very same case of where a patient was wrongly injected and then he lost the use of her arm. And then to say, how open are you to such cases, and which help can you offer for that particular patient? Because the national and provincial and whoever was consulted
did not be of any help to that patients. If you need her information, I'm available to give you the particulars of that particular lady who suffered at the hands of the medical doctor in our country. And the third one is based on the slide on page 35 that talks about persistent non-compliance in comparison with the slide in page 36. My question is, if you talk about persistence of non-compliance in connection with the time of the breach, how many times do you classify persistence? Is it once you commit an offense, once, twice, or thrice before you go on to the information? The call center number, if you just go on Google and search for the call center number for OHSC, you get three different numbers. Two are the Pretoria code numbers, the 012339 86 and 942 and 7707, and together with an 0800 number. How reliable are those numbers to the public for them to can get help? Because it's contradictory. You can't have three different numbers that are part and parcel of the call center. Call center is only one number, and it should be effective, which means there should be people who are always there to can take the problems as they are given to the department. Last one, page 65, slide 65. I just would like to ask about the security services. The budget on the security service, which increases, is increasing. It was from 105,990 for 2021 and to 2022. Is going to increase to 854,800. My question is there any is it insourced security services? If it's not insourced security services because you receive money there, why? And is there a possibility for insourcing? Say it's not. Is there a possibility of insourcing to take place? And if so, when will it be? On other payments and capital assets, other machinery and other equipment, I just want an explanation to say what are those other machinery and other equipment, because the expenditure here is doubled what it was in 2017/2018 was 454 something. Now for 2021 envisaged to 2022, it's doubled. 828126. What is it that is happening here that makes the budget to be doubled rather than to have one type of good solid furniture that will last us forever and forever? Amen.
Honorable Tembekwayo, you took 3 minutes. Can I ask members to stay within a minute, please?
We'll try, Chair.
Now, Honorable Chirwa, before you, Chirwa. Oh, didn't raise your hand.
No, I should.
Oh, okay, sure.
Thank you very much, Chair, and let us welcome the presentation. Some of the questions that I would have asked have been asked by my colleagues. One, the first question I want to check on is the inspection and certification of this health establishment. Have you ever received any resistance, particularly from the private, I am asking, when you do those inspections? The second question I would like to you for you to share with us, what are some of the experiences that you get for people to not to comply? Because I'm asking this question because you talk of enforcement and withdrawing the certification, closing. Have we ever closed any of the institutions because they are non-compliant? the other question I wanted to ask, what forms the 4-year validity of a certificate? I'm trying to look at the structure and try to see how long would it take for you people to go around all these facilities to inspect. Doesn't that hinder the monitoring? If I was compliant, I would be less famous if I knew that my certificate would come after 4 years. In the self-assessment, do you encourage peer assessment as well? Then on, in as far as the wealthy budget can never be enough because health is underfunded. So good luck to those who say you must be given money.
Thank you, Chairperson. My first question is why the appeal time frame limit is limited to 30 days after the inspection, and if there's a follow trail like of the places that you're inspecting, if it is public knowledge as well, and if it is, how do we access that, that the next place to be inspected is this place, so that we know we only have 30 days to appeal. And the consultative workshops, I want to know on the participation rate of the public in different areas, because we only have pictures of Mpumalanga and Limpopo and we don't know from which years they are. And what you deem as a successful workshop, like attendance, how many people would then result in a successful workshop? And also, okay, this was raised on the number of cases lodged by the public. No, it's not the one. Yeah, I want to know how, on average, what is the number that the public launches, like complaints that you get from the public on these institutions, and the rate at which you deal with the cases that are lodged. So like if there's like 5 cases lodged a year, how many cases you deal with and follow up on average. And, oh yeah, that's the one that was raised, but on the list of complying and non-compliant facilities, and if this, like, can we get a list of these facilities that are non-complying and those that are complying as well? You know, because I feel like you are reviewing yourself and we don't have enough material to review you back, you know, because you might mention facilities that we know for a fact are very problematic and they are complying in your books. And it doesn't reflect on our, you know, on our engagements with the public or the complaints that we get. So if we can access like the list of the inspections you've done, so we can have them and how easily accessible they are as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is more related to the function and almost the mandate of the Office of the Health Standards. I understand some of the inspections that you do, and it's very much around, my concern is very much, it's centered around a lot around compliance and not necessarily a qualitative and substantive view or assessment of our public health facilities. So to make an example, you spoke about how you would have a checklist or a questionnaire for inspectors to go into facilities and say, is this in place, is that not in place, is this in place? So the question, the problem with that is that there's a whole section of society that is not being necessarily, or there's a whole section of our health facility which is not being looked at, which is a qualitative sort of standard of healthcare which is being delivered, because the health facility may have a signage on the wall, may have this and you know, signs to the bathroom, but the health outcomes coming from that may be poor, or the experience of people in that facility may be poor. So my question really is the Office of the Health Standards, especially now that it's going to have a far more substantive function around under an NHI environment, is there some kind of move to make the office as role a lot more substantive than it currently is? I mean, I know that you're working also with the health ombudsman, but I mean, in both entities, I don't quite get a sense that there is a qualitative assessment of healthcare in the country. And so I'm very worried that we are missing out on that. And it might not be obviously your role, but I just want to understand, are we going to move towards that now that we've got this entity in place? Is there a concern that in fact we are not looking at quality rather than compliance?
Good afternoon once again. We appreciate your work and welcome your presentation. While I've been covered a lot by my colleagues, I just want a few matters of concern. On the question of how many health facilities have been recommended to be closed via you to the health minister thus far, how many clinics, how many hospitals, and private hospitals as well. I'm concerned about not only the building structures that you are checking on compliance, I'm also asking what's your limitations or how far do you go in your checks, in maintenance. I'm looking at linen changes and so forth of patients, because we don't want patients that are going to hospitals coming out more sick due to the nitty-gritty is not being done properly. We've been told about a registration app where as patients come in, or they would like every person to be on this registration app as you enter a health facility. Should there not be a survey added onto this registration app so that once you are on the registration app, you got an opportunity to say what was the service like at this particular health facility? And how many clinics and hospitals have been inspected thus far, and how many have been shut down for that matter, or how far are these cases? And on the last question, what type of litigation cases have you dealt with already?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll be brief because I think the majority of my questions have been covered. There's two issues I have concerns about. The first one being that I think the OHSC is a sitting time bomb, and I think it's about to blow up in our basis. I understand that there has been an increase in patient complaints since the Essa Dumeni tragedy, and it's not surprising because obviously this is the first time this department, the OHSC particularly, came to the fore and people realized that such a thing actually even existed. And that is why I think we suddenly saw this massive increase. You became known publicly, and I think that's increased the drama. The fact that you have no funding increased to go in line with that goes concerns. Particularly that in our recent report from the National Department, we have a registration of about 90 billion rand of Medicare claims. Now, while we understand an awful lot of those are false, and while we understand that billions of those are still in the space of letters of demand, it's astronomical, and it's certainly not going to help your department, because if anyone's got to deal with those, the health ombuds have got to get involved, and those figures are pretty astronomical. I'm not terribly sure how you're going to manage it, particularly without resources and staff, and I think that's very, very concerning. I think the independence that was discussed with us is equally concerning, but that's for another format. I just want to ask though, on program two, where you talk about certifying health establishments that are compliant with prescribed norms and standards, can you tell us, please, what your relationship is with the licensing of these departments? Licensing of clinics and hospitals is generally done at a provincial level. Okay. Now, we are receiving loads and loads and loads of complaints from all over the country that people cannot get their licenses, that it's taking 2 to 3 years, that they're getting no response. And I just would like to know what
where the association is between standards compliance and those applications, whether they be in clinics for dispensing licenses or the establishment of private hospitals, etc. I would really appreciate that. And my last concern is the amount of money that you're paying on leases. Mm-hmm. With that kind of money, you can buy a building. Mm-hmm. Quite frankly, in 2 years, with 20 odd million, you've got to be able to buy a reasonable building to contain your staff, which is not a huge staff contingent. Yes, we would like to see it bigger. But could you imagine what that 10 million could do on an annual basis as far as your staffing and resources is concerned? And the fact that this hasn't been done just absolutely blows my mind. Thank you, Chair. All for me.
Honourable members, just three clarity seeking from my side. Slide 33. There's a statement there on your presentation to Dr. Mdaweni. Why enforcement compliance notice? Bullet number 2 is to ensure that the healthcare users receive healthcare services of a suitable standard. Of course, you are about norms and standards. And I'm glad you raised it that you are also both inspecting private and public. In other places, when you visit public tertiary hospitals and ask them, what's your cesarean rate here? And they say, look, we are sorry, it's about 30%. I mean, there's a number of women who go and have caesar. 30% would have a caesar. And they say they are working on that, they are trying to reduce it to 25%. Yes, you could accept that. In private hospitals, cesarean section is 80%. Now, I want to hear from, and those reasons, and I'm familiar with some, are not really medical reasons to have cesarean section in those places. I want this child to have the same date of birth as my grandfather. I want this child to be born on a Christmas day. What do you do with that type of life? Because those things are not. And number 2, there has been an information that in private hospitals, you have to actually sign indemnifying private hospitals for whatever that they do. And the reason they give is that, no, the doctors who are going to look after you here are not our doctors. These are private doctors, but it's still within their premises. Now, it boggles my mind to say you must actually sign to go to theater and come back and be connected to a machine that has no oxygen, therefore must not indemnify anybody. I was surprised that in your presentation you did not have any mention of an ideal clinic. An ideal clinic realization, because some of the questions are coming in from there. Mm-hmm. How many clinics have you, because your status is to say, once they go this way, you call them a different name, gold, silver, whatever you want to do. That is important to actually indicate the ideal clinic. But the last question is related to what Honorable Kwakhube asked. Where are you in advising or supporting the Department of Health that it is not expected for staff members of Clinic A to go and borrow equipment from Clinic B, but just to where they can actually impress the inspectors? Because the inspectors are those who are going to come back and say, oh, Clinic A is shining, everything is well and good, and yet they are using glucometers, BP machines and everything that they borrowed there, and therefore they are given a status of being that good. And that was picked up here and there, and we said somebody must advise, they must just give the truth and the real truth that we do not have this equipment. And then, so that part is something that probably is not within your domain, but you probably might have picked it up, and how do you deal with it in advising the department in sorting it out? Thank you very much.
You can then.
Yeah, it's your turn now to answer. We'll start.
I have my colleague. First of all, I want to take a question that came about quality. I think it's the lady at the back there. This has been the one thing that worries me, that we are all sitting here, like Shakespeare says, we are on a stage. We are performing, and will soon disappear from the stage, and people will ask, what was your performance like? At the moment, we all measure numbers. You know, I've seen 20 cases, I've had 30 complaints. What we have not grappled with, and this is the fault of the Auditor General. He's like a banker. You bring money, it gives you get a little bit of profit at the end of the year, he tells you, oh, you're making a good investment. Now, health is not like that. It's not like banking. And I think you've allowed the Auditor General to determine the outcomes of health like we are a banking system. And that needs to be addressed. For example, after the Life as a Divani investigation, we made a number, I think there were about 15 recommendations. And all of them were of general nature as to how they impact on the health system. For example, we wanted the Human Rights Commission to investigate the status of mental health in the country and recommend. They have done that. They've produced a report. They've given that to the Minister of Health, and we'll see what that happens. So in health, it is not simply the number of investigations, but the quality of the impact that they give to the promotion and protection of the patient. And I think we don't pay good attention to that aspect of the issue. So I want to support the view that we must look into the issue of the impact of our activities as opposed to the numbers that we do, whether it's in terms of complaints or in terms of outcomes. I also want to support somebody who spoke about he wishes us luck, who wants money. You know, you'll remember there was once a man called Stix Murewa, and he's late now. He was questioned in a court and he was asked, why did you accept double pay? He said, it's because money is always useful. Now, we know money is useful, but nations have not developed because of money. Money is something that people created. We develop because we've got ideas. And I think let's not lose the perspective. Money is important and it's useful, but ideas are even more profound. And I think let's try and prioritize our ideas and see how we can, you know, tackle them rather than chase the money all the time and explain our failures in terms of money. I know that there are times when money actually is necessary, but human beings thought before they thought money was important, and that's not going to change. And let's remember that. I think those are the two areas I just want to touch on. Thank you.
I'll leave that.
You can come in as when you wish to.
I'd like to just comment on the difference between a health system and a health and an institution. With health systems, you're looking at the outcomes of a lot of institutions and a lot of health programs which improve the health of citizens. Within an institution, you need to look at it as an organization that looks at it's both an art and a science. For doctors and nurses to be able to provide the kind of comprehensive care, looking at attitudes and all of the softer side of which is critical to medicine, they can only do that in an environment which allows them to do that. So they have to have buildings which work, which have got all the kind of environmental factors that make it comfortable for staff, but also reduce infections with laminar flow and things like that. In addition to that, you need the technology that allows you to identify when there is a problem. And that technology should also tell you when things are going right. So it's critical, and technology is not only is something on its own, staff have to know how to use it. So there's a whole host of sort of fundamentals that are required. And then from there you go into the staffing component. Are staff able to do their jobs? Now, how do we do that? Well, first of all, there are a number of ways. It's not just an organization that's been properly inspected can get equipment from other sources, but you can also go and check. You can look at inventories. You can see, did they actually get this? Is this their equipment? And a good inspector will look at this and be able to identify it. So there are a whole host of ways that you can do that. In addition, if you want to look at the outcomes of care, you can look at how many adverse events are there, what is the infection rate, what is going on with regard to things like rapes in the hospital. There's a whole lot of things that you can find out about it from just by doing a proper inspection. So that's the one thing that I think we need to comment on. It's important that you have those checklists, but it's important that you look at those questions and interpret them deeper than just yes, no. And this is why the office have got a number of things. First of all, they've got, is it compliant? Yes, no. And why is it not compliant? And then a recommendation on how to improve it. So this is the way that the office is working towards trying to do that. With regard to your excellent question on continuous monitoring, you're so right. We need to continuously monitor performance. The office is in the process of developing a web-based information system which will allow hospitals to be able to enter their own data when they are trying to improve their quality improvement programs. The idea that we are working towards, the office is working towards, is to try to ensure that that database is available to you, to people who are privileged to have it. Not everybody can have it, but those people who, like hospital managers, like departments within the hospital, can look at their own performance, and not only look at their own performance with regard to the inspection of data, but can also start looking at what they are doing and whether it's actually changing those scores, because those scores are really very important. And to be able to, and there's a whole lot of science which has gone into determining what are the scores, what is a critical thing, what is less critical, how do we go about that. So there's a whole lot of things that we are developing to try and make the assessments as good as possible. So I think that answers the question. And I don't want to give lectures, so I'm going to stop here. But I think that it's important that, number one, there has been a lot of work that's gone into this, number one. And number two, there's a lot more that needs to go into it. And all your questions are valid. All of your questions are valid. But I think what we need to know is that if we are going to improve the quality of our public sector, and you're right, there's very, very big problems out there. We were going to have a system that people can use to understand where they are. We're going to have to be able to monitor it and then work towards improving it together. It's not a matter of us just saying the office is responsible for that. The provinces, the private sector, everybody needs to be gathering the information, determining where are the major flaws and working together to improve. Can we do that in this country? I really hope and pray that we can. I'm going to stop talking now. Sorry.
Thank you, Chair. I would just like to reiterate on what Prof. Whitaker has just said, that there is continuous improvement in the systems that we are using in order to check compliance. We've just developed a compliance status framework, which we will use now in our new inspections for this coming year. But also that it is important that we know that we have the inspection report 2016-2017, 2018-2019 ready, but we cannot yet give it to you. We will, before we come and present it to you in Parliament here, we will have sent it to you so that you can interrogate it. But it is complete, and we will await your invitation, Chair. So the report is there, it's available. The other thing that I wanted to say is that we have not yet started inspecting the private hospitals. That's why the CEO said, without the norms and standards, we couldn't go into the private hospitals. But now that we have the norms and standards, we will go into the private hospital. So we cannot say what is the difference between private hospitals and public hospitals. There are, if you look at a lot of research that is done by various universities, a lot of information is available for you to can make up your mind on what is, which care is better. It depends on whether you want curtains or nice food or what, or you want competence. So we look at competence, and as Prof has said, it's also about infection, making sure that we minimize infections, making sure that the patient's rights are adhered to, and all those things. So that's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable members, for the question posed. I'll try to deal with those that are still outstanding, and colleagues will also assist with others. But I think before I do so, it's important that I explain this matter, that before February 2018, we did not have the regulations. We were using the national core standards based on the documentation and the policy of the National Department of Health. Now, we are then now working as a full-fledged regulator, now that we have the regulations promulgated. So that would start from this current financial year's inspections, which then means the enforcement action that I described, because there were a number of questions that asked how many facilities were closed, how many did you recommend to the minister, how many did you withdraw the certificate of compliance. That would be, it's applicable now, which means when we come to the Health Portfolio Committee to present our annual report and our inspection report, that is the detail that we will have. So for 18-19, so, and we have a year to prepare once the norms and standards are promulgated. So they actually came into effect in February of 2019, this current financial year. So that report can only be available in the subsequent financial year, because we've got to give, that's what actually the Gazetteer was saying, we have to give that period of a year for health establishments to prepare and for the office to prepare. So we will not have such information available. However, based on the national core standards, we've got inspection reports that are available in our website. So we will be called again to come and share with you the inspection report of 2017-18 and 18-19. Then we'll go into detail in terms of how many did we find which were compliant and how many were non-compliant, but based on the national core standards, not the regulations, which is for that reason we couldn't go into the private sector. Now we can certainly go because we've got the regulations. The mandate of the office extends definitely into the private sector. That's the question that was asked. But I also want to explain something. I think it was Honorable Tembukwai who asked about the vision of the OHSC. Let me give the level of comfort, Honorable Member, that we've just finished our strategic planning for the next 5 years a week ago, and indeed it is one thing that we picked up, that our vision says for all South Africans. We have subsequently changed that to all healthcare users that are accessing healthcare services in the country. So the next strategic plan, when we come to this house, would definitely be different. I'm going to allow colleague Memontu to tackle the issue of the Mamelodi report, as well as Ntatetlhole to look at the issues around the numbers of the call center, and Ntate Maphata will deal with the finance questions. Now, there's a question that was asked by the Honorable Chair around us not mentioning the ideal clinic realization, which is a very important quality improvement program. Now, I need to once again clarify the role of OHSC as a quality assurer and the role of the National Department of Health. We should have programs that look into overall quality improvement. So we do, what we try to do is to make sure that we do not ask things that are different from what the team that would come and do continuous quality improvement, which is the IDRI clinic realization. But from time to time, as we interact, and particularly the provinces, they will also look at what our inspection findings were as compared to the IDRI clinic realization. So the ideal clinic realization is a continuous quality improvement program. We come in more as a regulator to do quality assurance. So the report that we will generate, we'll then be looking at those broad issues which we have identified as an organization that relate to quality assurance. However, it's a very, very important, I think, aspect to look at, because we need to see the point of convergence between the two and where each one, you know, takes over and why they, and it's something that always confuses people out there, but it's very important that we clarify the different roles of the two. However, very, very close linked and working in synergy with one another. We have had indeed, for now I'll say, allegations of people borrowing equipment or whatever, you know, to the clinic. But when we come, if we find hard evidence, it is actually an offense, and it is written in the act, because you are actually giving us misleading information, and you are misleading the very current situation of that health establishment. So in the event an inspector finds something like that, it will definitely be an offense for that particular health establishment. And we do emphasize this during, you know, our guidance and support to the health establishment, that let us not find you doing that, because it will not be left. Because remember, we come as a regulator, and we cannot allow such a situation. The appeal time frame, I also ask Advocate Makwedi here, but then most of the things that we have put in the appeal approach are actually, they are stipulated in the Act. So those time frames we absolutely have, there isn't anything that we can do. It is exactly as it is in the Act, and we cannot operate outside of that. Then I think for now, give an opportunity to my other colleagues to tackle some of the questions that are left out.
Thank you.
Can they use 5 minutes, please, combined?
Okay. Thank you, Chair. As the CEO indicated, I'm going to be answering the question relating to appeals, the validity period of the certificate of compliance, and the link between the OHSC certification and licensing by the provinces. In terms of the certification enforcement timeline, most of them are legislated. So the appeal process is actually stated in Section 88, capital letter A, subsection 1 of the Act. So the Act prescribes that an appeal should be lodged within 30 days from the date of gaining knowledge of the decision by the OHSC or the Ombud. And in terms of the validity period of the certificate of compliance, the 4-year period is also regulated or legislated in Section 82, subsection 7 of the Act. So it is prescribed by the Act that the certificate should be valid for a period not exceeding 4 years. And then in terms of the licensing and certification by the OHSC, one can maybe indicate the distinction as, in terms of licensing, the provinces license the establishment or development of new hospitals or health establishments, and the OHSC comes as a regulator to look at the quality of the services that will be rendered in that health establishment. So both processes are different, The province has that mandate in terms of Section 25 of the Act to say that they have to look at the development of public and private hospitals within their provinces. So they have a mandate. Then in terms of implementing that mandate, provinces then developed Regulation 158, which will guide the development of new private hospitals. And then they regulate issues such as the infrastructure, the number of beds, and all that. But as the OHSC, we come and look at the quality of the services rendered and then certify the hospital as compliant with those quality norms and standards. Yeah, I think that is all from my side. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair, and thank you for the opportunity. In response to the Mamelodi Hospital incident, as the office, we did go and investigate the matter, and we made recommendations to the NDOH. We sent the report to them for them to follow up on to the matter, and in actual fact, we do have a committee that manages all the EWS issues in the office, and this very Friday we're meeting to make a follow-up in terms of the implementation of the recommendations. So we didn't take it lightly, otherwise at the office we did intervene. And regarding the patient that lost a part of the body due to the injection, we didn't get that information. I will request that maybe the information should be forwarded to us. My email address is mmonto@ohsc.org.za. I appreciate if you can get it today, because on Friday we are sitting mmonto, M-O-N-T-S-H-O, @ohsc.org.za. If we can get the information as early as possible, because on Friday we've got a meeting with this committee, then we can discuss that and have a way forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'm going to respond to some issues that are raised around complaints, and the first one that I need to address is the number for the call centre. And just to give a background, the honorable members must appreciate that when the complaints management program was established within the Office of Health Standards Compliance in 2005, we did not have a call center. And what we then did, we had two numbers, which were interim numbers, while we were in the process of setting up the call center. And that is why you would see the 012339, which is no longer in use, because the communications unit has pulled those off the public platform to avoid confusion. And the only number that we are currently using is the direct call center number, which is 080-911-OHSC or 6472. So that is the number that we are currently using for the call center, which was launched in 2006 and was publicly communicated. In terms of the average complaints that we are receiving and how we handle this, per week we receive around 65 complaints, and on average per month we receive 230 complaints. And how we handle these complaints, because one of the parameters that we use, there's a matrix that we use to risk rate these complaints, and we've noted that most of the complaints that we receive are actually of low risk nature, which should be managed at the point of care. But because of the challenges in terms of complaints management at the point of care, That is why we are sitting with those. But we've tried to make arrangements within the call center, and that is why when the CEO was presenting, you would have noted that there's an indicator that we had to look on working around those low-risk complaints in response to ensuring that we do not find ourselves that the system is clogged with these complaints that are unnecessary for the level of the office of the Ombud. But I also need to speak to the issues just around medical legal claims. And one of the important areas that we need to appreciate is that complaints management in itself, it's a very important tool that can mitigate users of health services going to litigate against the health establishments. But because of failure at the point of care to actually address these complaints, that is why you would sit with these 60 billion, you know, medical legal claims. But with maturity and once as a country we understand the importance of the role that the Health Ombud has got to play, and with the capacity and people understanding that he can actually be able to assist in that process, it will make life very easy and ensure that these important costs that we should be using to improve the health of our communities would be used properly. But one of the challenges that we are also facing around these medical legal cases that I think it's important for honorable members to note is that we've seen a trend now of legal firms that will lodge complaints on behalf of users of healthcare services. And this is part of the legislative gaps that we find, because when you look at Regulation 32.2 of the procedural regulation, it allows any representative to lodge a complaint on behalf of a user, and therefore they use that clause to raise lodge complaints with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. In terms of the questions related to finances, the litigation cases, most of them related to the Lancaster Demeaning matter. That was around 2017. I think all of those have since been dealt with and clarified. So those are the main ones that we had. And on the issue of other machinery and equipment, these are photocopiers, printers, fireproof safes, and WAN and LAN, wide area networks, and telephony systems and switchboard. Most of them are electronic, and over time they get replaced. So that is why we budgeted for that. And in terms of lease payments, when we went to the current lease premises, we also had to get Treasury's approval before we could move there, because we didn't have the funds to do an outright purchase. But I think that is something that we have noted to check whether in going forward we can actually do an outright purchase for our own building. And on security services, for the last 4 years we were housed at the MRC, so we didn't really have to pay that much in terms of security costs. But now that we are on our own, we carry the whole responsibility. But we have noted the suggestion about insourcing, but currently it has been outsourced for a year, whilst we're busy reviewing our way going forward. So that is we will then consider that point. Thank you, Chair.
I notice that Prof wants to give the last shot.
No, it's not the last shot. I think somebody commented about the fact that after life as a demeaning, we have begun to see more complaints, which is very true. And the bottom line is that life as a demeaning report has been seen by over 13,000 news outlets throughout the world, whether it's China or whatever it is. Now, what the South African public has realized is that it is better to go to the Ombud and get a license to get more money than go and bet the lottery, because more millionaires have been produced by the Ombud after life as a demeaning than it has ever been done through the lottery. So there is a problem of patients or complainants looking for money rather than for justice. And that's the challenge that we face now in the office, whether this is for justice or this is really that I'm hungry and I need to be taken care of. But that's the challenge that we face after what we have. Thank you very much, sir.
Remember, I can't allow any more questions like this. That bell is saying we must be in the house. The bell is just rung. Thank you very much. As I was getting along, we are summarizing certain issues that we'll take along. Thanks for our input, Prof. We'll bring you back. Thanks to all the board members who are here supporting, and thanks for our input and chairperson. We are not in this space in V119 at 4 o'clock. Is it 4 o'clock? Half past four. It's V119 for another presentation of SAGRA. Very important to listen to them.